the toad. Waiting, wondering is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Get me up, be the biggest little flirt. Well, I might have...
Welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Hey, welcome to the Shame-Free Zone. This is Veronica Monet, your host. And my guest tonight has a brand new book called Laura Meets Jeffrey, Both Sides of an Erotic Memoir. Jeffrey Michelson and Laura Bradley, with a foreword and a commentary by none other than Norman Mailer. That got my attention, actually. And I thought we were going to be talking about how this book might be similar to Shades of Grey, you know, with the trilogy that's really popular right now. But I just found out what this book is about, and of course, with my background, that's what we're going to talk about. Apparently, Jeffrey, you fell in love with a hooker. Is that true?
That's the exact story.
Well,
and by the way, it's something I've done more than once in my life, but this was the most interesting of them.
Well, all I could say is you have taste and a heart. So tell me the story about Laura. First of all, how do you meet her? Is she working in a massage parlor or a brothel or on the street?
She worked in a brothel, an upper class brothel in New York City in 1980. A very clean place. Like as I write it, the whole place was so beautifully clean and it was so elegant that you felt, God forbid you needed it, you could have open heart surgery in any room. They kept them clean, and it smelled like eucalyptus, and it was a very upscale place.
Nice. Well, New York.
I had been there several times before.
Well, New York has some great brothels, or certainly has had some great brothels anyway in years gone by. So I'm not surprised. But what was so special about Laura then, if you had been there before?
We were just connected to each other. She was beautiful. She was great. Her body temperature was just like slightly above normal, I guess, because she felt so warm to me. And we were just made for each other. We had, this is back in 1980 when you would go to a brothel and it's not like today. Today you go, you can't kiss. You have to wear rubbers. Years ago, you would go to a brothel and you would go in and you would have sex or make love or whatever you want to call it. And it would be just like having sex with a girlfriend, except without the aggravation.
That's very funny. Well, you know, clients, the listeners know, and I think you know too, that I worked as an escort for 14 years. Clients fall in love with us all the time, but falling in love with a client, now that's another thing. What was it about you that, caught Laura's eye?
Just a magic chemistry. We were just the right people for each other. We were both artists and freaks and middle class, and we had an awful lot going with each other besides just great sex. We spent 3.5 years with each other.
Is this an actual picture of you guys on the cover?
No, it's not. That is a stock photo that's close. Laura wants anonymity. I have a photograph not dissimilar to that of her and I that I would show you if we were ever together. I look something like that, and the real Laura was actually better looking than the girl on the cover.
Oh, I'm sure.
She ended up being a lingerie model. Yeah, she was just stunningly gorgeous.
Oh, wow. So you've actually had a pretty glamorous life, and I want to get into that some. But before we do, kind of set it up for the listeners here, okay? I mean, just They're going to make a movie out of this, right?
I hope so. From your lips to God's ears. I mean,
okay,
you know, I'd love
there,
that. I would love that. I hope for that.
Grab the movie rights from your publisher.
I kept the movie rights, by the way.
Oh, you did? Oh, good for
you.
So you go to this high-class brothel in New York. It's the 80s. Describe it for us. I mean, when you walk in, do they hand you a glass of champagne, or is there cocaine all over the place? Or, I mean, you know, what
kind of... No, it looked like any other office. It looked like another office in this building full of offices. And you'd walk in, and as you were an escort. I don't know how you got your clients, but if you go to a brothel, you go through this thing called choice, which is that everybody goes, and all the girls there come in one at a time, tell you their name, do a spin or a turn, or let you know that they're going to give you a good time, and then you make your choice.
Okay. And do they, I mean, it's a nice brothel, so I've only been to, like, the Mustang Ranch, which is in Nevada City, when I was a client. I've been a client a couple of times, actually, two or three times.
You've been a client as well as a...
One should never sell a service that they're not familiar with procuring.
Oh no, I agree because I've been a hooker, a trick, and a pimp. I've been all three.
Oh wow!
And I've been totally comfortable in every role.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I'm going to have to ask you about being a hooker, but before I do, let's go back to. Anyway, they had, you know, the brothels in Nevada are just, they're horrible, you know, because they're illegal. And as soon as Uncle Sam becomes the pimp, it's very demoralizing and degrading. But they have, like, these barbed wire fences around the place, and the women are kind of held prisoner there. They don't have a lot of say in their working conditions. So I would imagine that the kind of brothel you're talking about, the women were probably educated and...
Some were, some weren't. There was a whole collection of women. There were women there who had actual pimps and came off the street. There were women of all kinds of nationalities and colors. I knew the owner. Prior to meeting Laura, I had been to the brothel one time, and the owner, who was this lovely, blonde, beautiful, middle-aged woman who passed herself off as Swedish, but was actually Polish, and and lovely, really a lovely woman. She was sitting there at the desk designing something, trying to figure out her business cards and an ad for the Yellow Pages. And I was an advertising designer, so that was easy to me. I sat and did my magic for her, and she said, "Wow, I love that." And she gave me a girl for free. That was the way she said thank you. So I became, and I would go there often. I was so sexual that I actually, there were times in my life when I would go to an orgy one day and a brothel the next, and then come home and have sex with my girlfriend. It wasn't my fault. I was the horniest man I ever met, but it's not like I chose it. It's like, you know, some guy who's 6'4". You can't go up to a guy who's 6'4" and go, "Wow, congratulations for being 6'4". He had nothing to do with it. Well, and I had nothing to do with my testosterone level. It was just, that's what I was given.
So it's very interesting, actually, the press release from your publisher says the long, strange road to sexual healing. So did you feel that there was anything about this lifestyle that needed to be healed?
Well, the book is about the fact that Laura and I meet, we fall in love, and she's really sliding, for whatever reason, into masochism. And it brought me into, I hate to say it, but I mean, I guess, I like to think of it as a master rather than a sadist, because sadist is such an ugly word, but we grew into a very, very master-slave relationship. This was a woman who wanted to be, I guess, I mean, I can say this is a woman who wanted to be whipped and gangbanged by as many men as possible.
Yeah, yeah.
And if I wanted I had to provide that. So I spent the next 3.5 years producing one amazing sex scene after another with me and with others.
Uh-huh. When you say producing, that you don't mean for
producing.
Film.
What?
For film?
No. Producing as in making manifest to creating. I would create opportunities for her. And we went to sex clubs and S&M clubs where she would live out her fantasies. She used to say that I would paint her sex fantasies with reality.
Now, are you familiar with Shades Gray?
Oh, yeah, sure. This is the best thing that ever happened to me. Why?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the zeitgeist is at my back. I mean, it's wonderful that this book has come out there. I've heard good and bad things about it, and I haven't read it. I love that a book about S&M, even if it's not true, because Shades of Grey is fiction and my book is nonfiction, but it's certainly setting the scene, and it's the first time since the late 80s that when AIDS came and made sex ugly in the media, this is the first post-AIDS period of sex being beautiful in the media.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and, you know, I think we're at this stage right now where if it's a housewife wrote this trilogy.
An English housewife.
Yeah, well, if she writes it, then it's kind of legitimized in the eyes of the public. I'm wondering, you are talking about being a man who is dominating your lady, and I'm just wondering if you have been as well received as, a woman who writes about a man dominating a woman.
Well, this book is by both Laura and I. I was working on the book, and before Norman Mailer died, I had just about finished the first draft. And he suggested, because he knew Laura, and he suggested that after I finished the book, I give it to Laura and let her write her side of the story.
Uh-huh.
And so this book is my writing and her speaking. Legs McNeil, who's one of America's great pop culture oral historians, interviewed Laura, and Laura also wrote her commentary on it. So the book is a combination of my writing and about 40 monologues of Laura throughout the book.
Well, so are you guys still good friends?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're friends. I mean, this is about a different era. She was a different woman and I was a different man. And this is something that is 1980. So what is that, 27 years ago?
Yes, it's some time ago.
32 years ago. This is 32 years ago. This is, we're both several incarnations since then.
Yeah. Well, are you still into BDSM?
No. I don't think either one of us was before or after. That's what the magic of this book was. And the way my publicist talked about sexual healing, for whatever it is, Laura needed to get some, I guess looking back, you'd have to say it was pain. She had to get some pain out of her, and once out of her, she didn't need to do it again.
So she was using...
We weren't really thinking about it when we weren't analytical when we were doing it. We were just having a great time. We were both incredibly sexual. You know, we couldn't get enough from each other or other people, and she just had a sex drive that matched mine. I guess in those days they called it sex maniac. Someone asked me recently, one of my publicists asked me if I knew what sexual addiction was. And I said, yeah, but I think, and I looked up addiction. In order for something to be considered an addiction, it has to have some negative quality to it. We had an incredible amount of sex, but there was nothing negative about it. We just enjoyed it. It didn't cause us any problems. We didn't suffer from it, and there was no downside to it.
So nobody caught any diseases or had an unplanned pregnancy or
no.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Well, you know, of course, BDSM is actually, if you know what you're doing with BDSM, it can be safe in a lot of ways because a lot of the, you know, bondage and discipline. Or did you do bondage discipline, or was it just sadism and masochism?
No, she'd like to be tied up. She certainly, yeah. It was bondage and discipline. And definitely, I guess, you know, thinking back, I guess it was more discipline than anything. She liked to be told what to do. And I'm a natural director, so I'm happy to tell her what to do.
Now, are you a film director?
No, I'm retired, but I was a TV commercials director for 20 years.
Right, and so John Lennon liked an advertisement that you put together or something?
Yeah, when this is earlier than I met Laura, I'm trying to think, maybe 7 years, I'm trying to figure out, 7 or 8 years. 6 or 7 years before I met Laura, I fluked into becoming a designer because I had done some work and John Lennon saw it and he liked it. It was what I would consider doing the ads for the Imagine album.
Yes.
And for Yoko Ono's Fly album, and he liked it. And he sent a note back to his creative director saying, I like this. I want this guy to do our stuff from now on. And so overnight I became the advertising and media designer for Apple Records.
Cool.
Yeah.
Very, very cool.
Yeah, a great fluke in my
life. Yes, well, obviously you've lived kind of a charmed life, haven't you? You just keep falling into all these amazing connections. You also were friends with Norman Mailer, yes?
Yeah, when I was 19, I think it was 19 or 20, I was Norman Mailer's houseboy and sparring partner.
As houseboy, what did you do for Norman?
Oh, it was his family. It wasn't just Norman. Norman, I had been living with this English woman. I'd gone to journalism school in England, and then we came back to America, and we went to Provincetown, because it's the most beautiful place in the world in the summer. And I had met Norman briefly for about 20 seconds the year before, but I knew he and his wife lived in town, and my girlfriend and I were working, and we had heard that he needed a house keeper. So my girlfriend got a job as a housekeeper for him, and then I would come visit her, and Norman and I would talk, and at one point he asked me if I would like to come to work for him because he had two young sons, and the rest of the entire house was full of women. He wanted another man around, plus he was out of town a bunch of times, and he wanted someone there who could perform male functions, and he asked me if I wanted a job, and I said yes, so my girlfriend and I moved in there. And as houseboy, it was, I helped clean and went and did the grocery shopping and picked up people at the airport. Most of it was no different than any houseboy would do for any wealthy celebrated couple.
Okay.
And in the afternoons, he was a boxer, and he wanted to know if I wanted to box. And I didn't know how to, so he taught me. And all I can tell you is the idea of being able to punch your boss in the face legally is one of the most wonderful events you can have in anyone's life. So here okay. I was working for this guy, and I liked him. We got along really well. But in the afternoon, 3 days a week, we'd put on gloves, and if I could get my fist in his face, I was able to hit my boss.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, now, what was it about your book that made him want to write the foreword and the commentary for it?
He felt that it was a great historical document as well as a wonderful love story.
Wow.
He thought that, what did he say? He says, between the appearance of the pill in the late 60s and the first onspread of AIDS in the 80s, there was an opening, call it a broad highway, into a wide open world of sexual experiment and laissez-faire promiscuity. A great many Americans went off on a nonstop gymkhana of libido exercises and group excursions. Jeffrey Michelson's book captures the heart of that 15-year period with a directness and candor that lifts his work above the directly pornographic. The result is most readable, and considering his own involvement, surprisingly objective and funny. A subtle pathos mixes with an unquenching optimism, and the result, no matter what a plethora of the salacious we have here, is perversely, dare I say it, uplifting.
So Jeffrey.
That's what he left
me. I have to ask you a question. In your assessment, do you think you are as gifted a writer as Norman Mailer?
Oh, God, no. No.
So,
no, I don't. I'm a really good writer. If this book does any real business, it's because it was a team effort. I'm a really good writer. If Norman hadn't come up with the idea of Laura writing her side of the story, writing and speaking her side of the story, this would have been a decent book by an interesting guy who wrote about his sex life. But this book was, first of all, my girlfriend Joanna, who's a brilliant editor and worked for daily newspapers and magazines, she helped edit the book from the beginning.
Okay.
I wrote it. Legs McNeil got involved, and he wrote Please Kill Me, and he's like a great, great writer, editor, and oral historian. He read the first draft, and he was so impressed with it that he decided to take a couple of weeks out of a very busy schedule and re-edit the book. Then when it came time to interviewing Laura, he volunteered for that. And then he edited her words and put it in throughout the book. So it's Legs McNeil, it's Norman Mailer, who helped edit, was the first editor. It's my girlfriend Joanna, it's me writing. And then Michael Lennon, who's a professor of English and is writing Norman Mailer's biography that's coming out in, I don't know when, what year, but I guess Simon & Schuster was the winning bid for that book. He was the last editor, and he wrote, he read it 2.5 times and did a line-by-line, comma-by-comma edit. There's another person who was involved in this, Norman's widow, who's now passed herself, Norris Church Mailer, who was inspirational to me because of the first draft. Nobody loved the book more than Norman, and nobody hated it more than Norris. And she had me change it. I really wanted to please her. And she liked the writing, and she thought I was a great writer, but she thought there were too many characters in it, and she thought it was just, this was way before Laura got involved in it, and she thought it was just some guy, it was too much of a guy bragging about his sex life.
Sure.
And so when I went to re-edit it, I threw out 60% of the book, and she said, make it a love story. Tell the story about you and Laura, because she knew Laura. And I totally changed the book, and for the better, for sure. So it was really a group effort. There was a bunch of people involved in this book.
Yeah. So you have a background in writing, actually, as in creating a magazine called Puritan.
Puritan was was the first hardcore sex magazine that was a real magazine. In 1976, I started it. It was explicit,
right?
Like insertions and erections. But we had real writers. We had Norman Mailer and Timothy Leary and Hunter Thompson and Philip Jose Farmer and Terry Southern.
Really? And they were talking about explicit sex?
Yep. They would do interviews and write stories right next to the goods. Right next to the real stuff, yeah.
Yeah. That is really fascinating.
Yeah, it was a very successful magazine that ran for a very long time. I only did it for a couple of years, and then I left, took off some time.
Well, you created the magazine, so did you sell it?
I did okay.
Yeah.
I have no complaints, yeah.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, did you get a chance to meet all these people, Timothy Leary and Tennessee Williams?
Some of them, some not. Tim Leary and I became friends. Tim and his then-wife Barbara and Laura and I spent a bunch of time together. I liked him. He was a good guy, yeah.
Yeah,
That's the last acid I did.
You also,
in 1981. Tim gave me some acid. That was the last time I did acid.
Yeah.
1981.
With Was it Timothy Leary?
No, I didn't do the acid with Tim Leary, but he and I and Laura certainly consumed a lot of drugs together, that's for sure.
I would imagine so, because you make no bones about it. You were not only having sex whenever you wanted and however you wanted, but there was also a lot of partying going on.
Yeah, I lost my taste for drugs early 90s. I just absolutely just didn't want them anymore. I just wanted to be sober and straight, and I've been sober and straight since then.
Did you have to go through a 12-step program, or?
Did I have what?
Did you have to go through a 12-step program?
Oh, no. I'm not a particularly addictive, I don't have a particularly addictive biology.
Okay.
Like, there were people who could do drugs one day after another. If I did any kind of drugs one day, I'd have to give myself a couple of days off. I just didn't have the biology to become an addict.
Yeah. Well, that's very fortunate, because you were also fronting bands like Max and the Broadway Medical Choir.
The Broadway Medical Choir. I like that.
Oh,
no, it's the Broadway. I like that. The Broadway Metal Choir.
The Metal Choir.
I like that.
You
the know, Broadway Medical Choir. After Laura, I took
well,
off.
If it had anything to do with BDSM, that would actually be rather apropos.
Yeah, I guess. My next artistic endeavor was I took off some time. I bought a bass guitar, taught myself how to bass guitar, went to England, put together a band, and was in a rock band for about 3 years.
So
I had to get that out of my system.
You were in a rock band.
Yeah, I was Max in Max and the Broadway Metal Choir.
Were you singing or?
Yeah, I was. I had played. I was a bass player, and but I wasn't a particularly great musician, and I started writing music I couldn't play, so I had to hire a bass player.
Oh no! Okay.
Yeah, I was writing music above my pay grade.
Wow.
So, I hired a bass player and became the lead singer of this band, which we did for a couple of years. I had a great time.
You're just all over the place here, because after that, you end up getting arrested and you were facing a mandatory 3-year sentence for producing porn?
Well, yeah, I went from doing Puritan to doing, I got an offer to do a high-end explicit sex book. And when I was in L.A. shooting, I got arrested for pandering because the police were trying to go around First Amendment and pornography laws by arresting people who hired performers and charging them with pandering, being a pimp. Because it was there was a minimum. I'm trying to try to remember exactly what it was. There was a minimum 3-year jail sentence I was facing. But ultimately, the California Supreme Court adjudicated that I was not only not guilty, I was factually innocent.
Okay.
About $100,000 later.
Yeah, right.
Which they don't give you back.
Yeah, nor did you get an apology, probably.
Oh, of course not.
Well, look, I'm looking at the table of contents of your book. I confess, I haven't read it. I've skimmed it. I mostly had some very interesting conversations with your agent about the book. But you've got very, very enticing chapters in here. So there's one here, chapter 29, that says Sex Slavery at Club O, March 1981. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I'm not asking you to read the book. You want people to buy the book, but just...
Laura and I used to go to sex clubs because she liked to be paraded around and used by other men and be brought into interesting situations. And one night we were at this club, Club O, which we had gone to before, and ran into a lesbian couple, a master and a slave.
Okay.
And the mistress took a fancy to Laura, and wanted to trade me her slave. And this is about that exchange.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
All I can tell you is that there were, it ended up with four people winning. That's all I can tell you.
Everybody was happy, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, but it was very strange because it was a lesbian couple.
Yeah.
And, you know, the girl made believe, the girl said, oh, no, not with a man. But then I found out that she really liked to. She wanted to be pushed there. You have to read it.
Yeah, absolutely.
You have to read it. I guess you will now, though.
Oh, of course.
You might actually read the book, right?
Well, if I'm doing
my job right.
That's the point. Hopefully we'll get some other people interested in reading your book, too.
And it's available at Barn. It's available at every place that sells ebooks right now. It's available as an ebook at Amazon and every other single place in the world that sells ebooks. And it'll be coming out as a trade paperback in June, and in late June it's coming out as a bonded leather bound with black foil embossed and black end papers as a hardcover, as a high-end hardcover.
Yeah, sounds very high-end. Sounds lovely, beautiful.
I thought the idea of doing it in all black, with black instead of gold foil, using black metal foil on black leather.
Ooh.
It just seemed the right. It seemed the right medium for this book.
Gorgeous. Once again, for the listeners, the name of this book is called Laura Meets Jeffrey, Both Sides of an Erotic Memoir. And for those of you who are into the Shades of Grey trilogy, which, of course, is all fictionalized, this is promises to be better because it's the real deal. It really did happen back in the 80s. Laura Meets Jeffrey, Both Sides of an Erotic Memoir. And with me tonight is one of the authors, Jeffrey Michelson. And Jeffrey, I was going to ask you, there's a chapter in here called the Cocaine Ponzi Scheme.
Right. If there's one thing I would live my... I don't know if I... Nobody gets a chance to live their life over anyway. But
no.
I don't have many regrets. The one thing I think I could have lived without was the drugs. And I never loved cocaine. Some people just love cocaine. I never loved cocaine. It was okay, but it was annoying, and it interfered with sex. Women seemed to like cocaine even more than men because they didn't have the job of getting a hard-on.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
that's
cocaine could actually interfere with it. And that was there was a period of time when people thought that cocaine was a good thing. It was just a huge fraud perpetrated by a group of people on themselves, really.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see what you're... That's why you're calling it a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, it was. It was a Ponzi scheme.
I remember what we said in the 80s about cocaine was it's non-addictive.
Yeah, that's what people thought. It was it was total bullshit.
That was hilarious to me, man.
It was a fraud. It was, as I said, I think it's a fraud that... I mean, you can blame dealers and people who were in it for the money, but I think mostly it was a generation defrauding themselves, or part of a generation.
Sure. It certainly took a toll on my life. That was long, long time ago. Yeah. But
Personally or around you? Or both?
Oh, no. On me personally, I did it for a couple of years.
To be honest, if you could, there's lots of parts of your life you're proud of and lots of part of your life you're neutral on. If you could eliminate that by going back, don't you think if you got a second chance, you might do less or no cocaine?
You know, actually, probably not, because for me, going through the addiction and watching my life fall apart, it led to my getting into 12-step recovery, and it really changed my life in an incredibly positive way. So if I hadn't had drug addiction, there's a certain journey I would have never taken spiritually, and my life would have lacked depth because of it.
I understand that. I understand
that.
Yeah.
So I got a question for you, Jeffrey. You mentioned that not only were you a client who went to see prostitutes at these high-end brothels in New York, but that you also worked as a hooker. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, that's being really broad. There were a couple of times in my life where, I guess the first time was, I was at this bar, the Sherry Netherland in New York, that had hookers in it, and this drunken woman, not particularly attractive, but a young drunken woman came over to me and grabbed me, and she says, "It's my birthday, and you're my present."
Oh.
And she was a hooker. She said, I've been having sex with men that I didn't want to have sex with, and I like the way you look, and I was listening to you talk, and I want to have sex with you. I'll get a room here. Would you take care of me?" And I said, "Yeah, great." And then we became friends, and she would call me every once in a while with the name of some woman who she thought I would like, and that I have no idea what she collected from the woman, but I just got a mere pittance, but it was a lot of fun. So
okay.
I spent, I don't know, half a dozen times servicing some women that she set me up with.
Yeah. Did you?
I love the being used part.
The being used part.
Oh, my God, yeah. Some woman who was using me. I loved it. But then I'm a guy, and it's an odd situation, and I was quite happy, and I was so horny, it really didn't matter. And, you know,
Jeffrey, can you define used? Since we're talking about BDSM, I don't know if
it was very vanilla. Just that she was buying me and using me for sex.
Uh-huh.
It gave me a level of confidence I couldn't have achieved any other way.
Okay.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
You know, you have to understand, you know how they say, you know, if a man had to, he would have sex with a snake? This was way above that.
I hear that's your take on it. It certainly met lots of men that I just don't think would probably conform to that description.
Yeah, but I'm just saying is that men are so horny, they'll do just about anything. And
yeah,
this was a lovely level, and I really enjoyed. Oh, and it's great. I mean, there you are. You're giving a woman pleasure. You're getting paid. I mean, when you were an escort, weren't there moments that it was just an ideal situation?
I really enjoyed my work for a lot of reasons, but then I was practicing it as a sacred prostitute. So, it had a spiritual component to it. I really had kind of stopped doing the just out to have a good time stuff when I got sober, which was back in 1985. So for me, escorting was, you know, something that I invested a great deal of love and caring into my connections with my clients, and that's why I had most of my clients for a good, you know, 15 years. So, you know, we're all different. We all have different paths, but I'm curious.
Were you an escort before and after being sober?
No, I was just in sobriety.
Oh, you were an escort just after you became sober. Interesting.
Yeah. I've never worked in the sex industry when I was a drug addict.
That's a good thing.
Not wasn't my experience.
So you came into it with a clear head.
Very much so. College degree and a clear head. So tell me a little bit about Laura's healing journey around this. So apparently she's the one who wants to remain anonymous, and when you're published or put together the heading that it's a long, strange road to sexual healing, they were mostly talking about her. True?
Yeah, although I certainly benefited from myself. She went through this period after we split up. I think she continued on that road she was on, not so much of the S&M, but she remained addicted to cocaine for quite a while,
oh,
and then cleared herself out of both of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, ultimately we split up because she liked cocaine more than me.
Oh, yeah.
Not that she liked cocaine more than I like cocaine. She liked cocaine more than she liked me. And I ultimately...
thank you. Thank you for clarifying that. Maybe that's a female thing, because I have to admit, when I was addicted to cocaine, there were many times when I liked it a lot better than my fiancé, too.
That's the terrible part about drug addiction, is that humans become number two.
Oh, for God's sake, yes, absolutely. Actually, you know, my fiancé loved it, too, and I used to always lament the fact that he never cheated on me when we were together, but certainly had another mistress, and it was that white powder, most definitely.
Yeah.
So she got sober.
A couple years later, she got, she was completely sober for about a year or two.
Uh-huh.
She cleaned it out of herself. She was no longer into S&M. And then she met a guy and got married and has three kids and has a wonderful life of creativity and lives in Pennsylvania and has a lovely house and a lovely home. And she's she's the best mother I ever met. She has a son and two girls, and she has the best relationship with her kids of any parent I ever met. I can honestly say that.
Now, do you think, does her family know about her past as an escort, or is that something that she's kept?
That's something I don't know exactly. I mean, I know her husband knows some of it.
Yeah.
But that's the reason why she wants anonymity. She doesn't want to end up as the mommy in her girl's mommy porn.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a tough one. It's a really tough thing for women to... for myself, I was out. I was doing major media for 20 years, actually. For 15 of those, I was working as an escort. So... And I was married, and I had stepkids, so that's a tough road. And we wound up in family court over it, and so I can totally understand why she'd want to protect that.
Yeah, I think it was wonderful that she did. She took part in the book as much as she did, and she wants to remain anonymous. And I will do everything I can to make sure that that continues.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's great that she. Agreed to do the book with you, because a lot of women, when they close that door, they don't even want to crack it open a tiny bit.
Well, she's an artist. She respected Norman. She knew who Legs McNeil was and respected his work and still was friends with me and understood the project. And I'm giving her, she's going to benefit financially from it. So there's all kinds of reasons to do it.
Did Norman Mailer, encourage you to write this book?
He didn't encourage me to write the book. Once I had shown him an early draft of it, then he definitely encouraged me, And it went nowhere at one point, and I put it away. And two or three times a year, he would say, Jeffrey, you must finish this book. It really is something. And as I write in the book, he died in 2007, and on his deathbed, he extracted a promise from me to finish the book.
Oh.
So I had no choice, and I retired. He died in November of 2007. I retired on February 11th, 2009, and I started the book. I went back to the book the next day. And have been working on it until it came out about 2 weeks ago. It's just recently out. Until it came out, I worked on it with my girlfriend Joanna almost continually, 2.5 years, something like that.
Wow.
Almost 3 years.
Well, you kept your promise to him, didn't you?
Yeah, I don't know any other book that had this much post-production to it. I mean, the editing on this book was, as I said, there was Norman, then there was Norris, then there was Legs McNeil, there was Joanna, and then there was Professor Mike Lennon. This book has been really honed and polished, and they made something that was good great.
So Norman actually did some of the editing as well?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Early on, sure, before he died. Yeah, yeah. He taught me how to edit, too, which is more important than anything.
Wow.
He taught me to get rid of everything until you only have good stuff, and then cut out the good stuff.
That's the painful part.
Yeah, he suggested to get rid of certain characters, and he taught me to avoid adverbs as much as possible and be very sparse with adjectives and let nouns and verbs do all the heavy lifting. Taught me how to write. He taught me to edit out loud. Patting your hand against the desk like so you get the rhythm of the words. To say the words out loud. When you're editing, speak the words, because ultimately other people are going to be speaking them in their heads.
Yeah.
Oh, and lots of stuff. I mean, he was very involved, and he knew his craft. And
Maybe you should write that book. That's the book I'll read.
What? He wrote that book. It's called The Spooky Art. He wrote a book about how to write.
Yeah, but you could write a book about learning to write from him.
Well, I discuss it in my book. There's parts about it. The very last part of my book, the last chapter, is 10 Things I Learned from Norman Mailer.
That's very cool. Jeffrey, I want to ask you about your own, character arc here in your stories. You're the leading man here. Laura, obviously, had to get sober from the cocaine, and she stopped escorting, and she got married, and is now the mother of children. What about you? How is your story?
Well, I went from Laura to going to a rock band in London, and getting together.
We talked about that. I'm curious about where you're at this point. Do you still do drugs?
I live on a horse ranch. I spent the last 15 years riding cross-country events. I was a producer of TV commercials. I have a great relationship with a woman. I am, at some level, polyamorous. I have more than one lover. They get along. I get along. I have no complaints.
When you say polyamorous, that's actually a word that means many loves, as opposed to being promiscuous, which is just about many loves.
Oh, yeah, I don't, first of all, when I wrote this, as I said, it's 32 years ago. I'm 65 years old. I was a different guy then. I'm not that guy now. Sex isn't as important to me. I'm involved with growing vegetables and raising and riding horses, and that's my life.
You have an organic vegetable garden. What about BDSM? Is that something that you went deeper into?
I went from Laura and being involved in that world to the next woman in my life was I got back together with my ex-wife, who's an English aristocratic hippie, and who is into the most loving, warm sex. Maybe I'm a chameleon, but I just went.
Have you ever heard that subs talk from the bottom? You ever heard that?
Say that again.
Submissive people talk from the bottom.
They talk. I know that. I write about that in my book. Laura was my slave, but she controlled the relationship.
I know. I was just going to say maybe you were actually doing what she told you to.
Oh, I definitely was, but she wanted a dominant male, and I'm a naturally dominant male. But the woman after Laura was my ex-wife, who has one of the most beautiful relationships with sex of any woman I ever met, and is into loving sex. And I was afraid. I was afraid after Laura that I wouldn't enjoy normal, happy, loving sex. But my ex-wife, who I got together with again for a couple of years, she reinvigorated me and repositioned me in the world of love.
Oh. So I do. I hear an arc to this story, too. It's like So it sounds like you have, I wouldn't say you've settled down, but you definitely refocused yourself on
I would say I settled down. And then there's just the gift of the fact that your testosterone level ebbs. You know, I was either blessed or cursed with this ridiculously high level of testosterone, which made me enjoy boxing and football and incredible amounts of sex. And then it goes away, and then you get to lead another life, which is wonderful. I mean, I was happy that I had that, and I'm happy it's gone.
I hear you, Jeffrey. And just, you know, I don't know if you know this, but I'm actually a certified sexologist now, so I just need to say to my listeners that not everybody's testosterone levels go away at any particular given age. A lot of that is
I wouldn't say mine has gone away. I would say that it has abated somewhat.
It sounds like that's a total
I still love sex. I still love sex. I think it's very integral to having a good relationship. I was talking to Joanna, who I live with, and for a couple, I think sharing a pair of orgasms is at some level the only way to hit the reset button emotionally with another person.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think it's, I don't know if it's the only way, but it sure is a damn good one.
In some ways. No, there are other ways, but it has its own effect on a couple. Just being able to do that, it makes you fall in love and be romantic again.
Sex is a beautiful, wonderful thing. It really is. It's great for our health. It's great for stress. It's great for sleeping disorders. It's great for bonding. It's great for love. It's great for, I think, you know, reminding us.
Exercise?
What?
Could sneak exercise
too
in there? Oh, yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I think it's incredibly critical to our goodwill and our good health.
Absolutely. What do you think about the recent backlash that some of the conservative forces seem to be trying to take us back to the dark ages as far as women's reproductive rights go?
Oh, I mean, you know, it's obviously wrong to me. I can't understand it. In which I can't understand how any woman can agree with it. I mean, I don't understand how any woman at all. What kind of brainwashing could they go through to accept that in their husbands and agree with it?
I
don't understand. I can understand the warped minds of conservative men who want to see that kind of world, but I can't understand the women who agree to it.
Or the women who vote for these candidates. It's shocking to me.
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole other discussion about religion, and, you know, I was totally surprised that Rick Santorum had any effect at all, not only that he had as large effect as he did, and the things that he said that were just anathema to the way I believe, that's for sure.
Yes, exactly. Well, believe it or not, we're coming up at the top of the hour here, and I want to give you an opportunity to tell our listeners how to find your book. And are you going to be doing a book tour? Will people get a chance to get their book autographed? Or
Well, that's all being decided right now by the publicist I'm working with. I can tell everyone that the book is available as an e-book in Nook and Kindle in every format possible, and that if they wait till June, it will be available on my... Oh, I want everybody to go to the website, lauramechjeffrey.com. I designed this website with some friends of mine. It's terrific. It's a lot of fun. LauraMeetsJeffrey.com. And the paperback edition will be out in early June, and there'll be a hardcover edition in late June, and then I'm working on an audiobook that should be out in July. And Stephen Mailer, Norman Mailer's son, who's an actor and who does a brilliant imitation or a channeling of his father, is doing all the Norman Mailer parts of the book as his father.
Oh, you're kidding.
No, there's an interview. Laura and I did this interview with Norman Mailer that appeared in Puritan, and Norman loved enough that he had it anthologized in some of his works. Even before he died, he said it was one of the four or five best interviews he ever gave out of 600. And there's an excerpt from it in the book. There's also an excerpt from the interview that Laura and I did with Tim Leary, that's in this book, too. They're kind of like bonus chapters.
Fabulous.
Laura meets Jeffrey at Amazon.com, right?
Laura meets Jeffrey at Amazon.com and also LauraMeetsJeffrey.com, right?
Yeah, go to see LauraMeetsJeffrey.com. Please do it yourself. I think you'll like it.
I will.
And a friend of mine and I, a friend from my band days in England, helped me score it. It's a whole little show.
Oh, you're kidding! So you got absolutely. Everybody, go over. I'll put it on Facebook for you too.
Great.
LauraMeetsJeffrey.com. Jeffrey, I really think you're going to get a movie out of this. I really do. Just got
well. I hope
on.
So. I'd like it. It would be nice to. I mean, the goal of my life was to lead a great, wonderful, very exciting life, then retire, write about it, and turn that into money.
Yes.
You know, I did okay. I did okay, but it would be nice to elevate myself financially from a true story of the life I led. That would be that would be a sharp way to win, I think.
Well, you certainly got a lot of very interesting players in your story. That's for sure. Not everybody gets writing lessons from Norman Mailer. That's pretty awesome.
And the other thing is working at Apple Records. With John Lennon?
Yeah.
I mean, that was really a group of talented guys, kids. We were mostly kids.
Yeah.
Going to work every day, bring in your A game. I mean, there's nothing more than working for the Beatles that's going to bring out the best in you.
Awesome. All right, Jeffrey, thank you so much for joining us in the Shame-Free Zone and for being out and proud as a former client and a former hooker. Right on. Good for you.
Thank you very much. By the way, my book had different names, but Shameless. It was called Shameless for about 11 days.
Hey, see, you were channeling it.
Yeah, I love the name of your show. Shame-Free Zone is just brilliant.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you for having me.
I'm going to be looking for that movie. All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with you. Sering kesepian.